You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 24th of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by the Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One and from just down the road at the Monocle Cafe. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, a European spying row, rifts in the White House over Syria, and a secret deal on drones in Pakistan. Jeffrey Kaufman and Raffaello Pantucci are here to go through the day's top stories. Then we head to the year 2050 to hear how we pulled back from the brink of disaster in 2022. Jonathan Porritt, author of The World We Made, is here to explain more.
We're on the right journey. We've turned around this crazy juggernaut of life-trashing progress today, and we've created something that actually works far better for the vast majority of human beings.
Ever the optimist. Plus, we'll meet Kevin O'Hare, the director of the Royal Ballet, down at the Monocle Cafe, and there'll be some music and a look ahead to the rest of the day here on Monocle 24. That's Aperitivo with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. So rather a lot coming up in the next 60 minutes and kicking us all off. Here's David Spencer with the latest world news headlines.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. Claims of US spying on European allies has dominated the opening of an EU leaders' summit in Brussels. French President François Hollande called for a discussion of the issue at the meeting, following reports that millions of French phone calls have been monitored by America's National Security Agency. Earlier, the US ambassador was summoned to the German Foreign Ministry after claims Washington had also spied on Chancellor Angela Merkel's mobile phone. Newspapers in Germany have called the claims outrageous, with one saying that if it's true, the spying would be like a punch in the face. At the summit, EU Justice and Fundamental Rights Commissioner Viviane Reding's spokeswoman, Mina Andreeva, said it was time for common action.
Data protection must apply no matter if it concerns the emails of citizens or the mobile phone of Angela Merkel, and that now is the time for action and not only declarations at the EU summit, because European leaders have the chance to show that now the data protection reform can be adopted by spring 2014, and this would actually be a declaration of independence of Europe.
It's been revealed that the bushfires, which destroyed more than 200 homes in the Blue Mountains area of New South Wales, were started by an Australian army exercise. Residents have been allowed to return to their homes, but the crisis is far from over, with more than 50 blazes still burning. And investigations found that the biggest fire was started when an explosion ignited bushland during an army training drill. Meanwhile, the pilot of a plane which was dropping water on the fires in southern New South Wales has died after crashing into forests in a national park. Rural Fire Commissioner Shane Fitzsimmons.
Despite the best efforts of trying to get rescue crews in as quickly as possible, in very difficult, dangerous and windy conditions. The insertion of the ambulance rescue officers on arriving in the scene confirmed that the pilot had died. As I understand it, he's a 43-year-old man, he's a husband with young children, and we are all acutely aware that there's a family suffering tonight or today because their dad hasn't come home.
Kenya's police chief has warned journalists over their coverage of last month's terror siege at the Westgate shopping centre in Nairobi. The warning from David Kimayo follows reports of looting by soldiers. He said reporters should not provoke propaganda. CCTV footage has been leaked on local media, which appears to show soldiers taking items from a supermarket. The army has said the soldiers were only taking water. French football clubs are to stage a strike at the end of November over plans to impose higher taxes on players. The strike will affect matches in the country's top two divisions, and instead of games, there will be events at the grounds for fans to attend. Clubs are opposed to plans to tax anyone earning more than €1 million to pay a 75% so-called super tax that the clubs would have to pay. It will be the first strike to hit French football since 1972. Politicians in Nigeria are investigating claims that the country's aviation minister bought two bulletproof cars for $1.2 million. The MPs have been asked to look into the claims by President Goodluck Jonathan. He set up a panel of experts to look into the claims against Stella Adua. Tributes have been paid to the Indian singer Manu Dey, who's died aged 94. He was an icon of Indian cinema and had a number of hit Bollywood songs in a career spanning six decades. He'd been ill for the past few months and was in hospital for a respiratory infection. Prime Minister Manmohan Singh described Dey as the king of melody. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
David Spencer, thank you very much indeed. I think it's quite hard to feel any sympathy for millionaire French footballers having to perhaps pay a little bit more tax.
Yeah, the clubs having to pay it, I think, is the bit that's obviously irked the clubs. I like the fact that they're putting on events for fans anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, party balloons and things. It's not the same as a football
match. I can't see many people turning up to that. David, thank you very much indeed. It's 18.06 here in London, 13.06 in New York. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tuvai Monocle, vada se che che che.
From London,
London. London, Caracas.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Aperitivo. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Geoffrey Kaufman, a London-based correspondent for ABC News, and Raffaello Pantucci, senior research fellow at the London-based think tank RUSI. Welcome, both of you. We're going to start today with the most recent fallout from Edward Snowden, another leak, another world leader who's shocked, I say, to find out they're being snooped on. Yes.
Steve, is there a note other, of cynicism yeah. about this? Or?
Well, let's separate out these two things. So in the last day or so, we've heard, you know, concerns from Angela Merkel that her mobile phone has been tapped. And it's taught everyone who didn't know this that a German mobile phone is called a handy. So I feel like at least we've learned something there. So there's that. And there's also the issues with Mexico as well that have come up in recent days that Felipe Calderon, the former Mexican president, his email was allegedly hacked, that Enrique Peña Nieto, when he was running for election, he's now president, that his text messages were being read. We'll come on to the issue of what's happened in France in a moment there, because I think that's something slightly separate. But Geoffrey, yes. I mean,
Forgot Dilma Rousseff.
We've had Dilma Rousseff as well, the
president of Brazil. The list is very long, which makes the denunciations a little bit harder to believe. I mean, you know, at some point, if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it is one.
And
it's interesting. You can understand, on one hand, Merkel's outrage. The relationship is so close and so respectful, at least outwardly. In a sense, it's like a marriage, and you find that your spouse has been actually spying on your or eavesdropping on your mobile phone calls.
And as someone pointed out, sort of just because they can doesn't mean that they should.
Well, the denunciation from the White House is cryptic. We are not and we will not. And if you listen,
the present tense and the future tense, but not the past.
Very good. Yeah. Very good. And exactly. And that's why. There is reason to be a bit skeptical here, and there, you can understand the outrage. But on the other hand, as you noted in your introduction, this is so widespread.
And Raphael, I mean, should we be surprised at spies spying?
No, I mean, clearly we shouldn't be. And I think anyone who is sort of living in another dream on another planet. But I think that it's interesting here that it stretches to Germany, because Germany does have a sort of a different history around these things. If we go back to look at the Stasi in East Germany, and that sort of history hangs over them quite heavily. And they're very prickly and careful around these questions. When the issue of drones and whether, you know, American intelligence was being given, he was using German-based intelligence to sort of decide to hit targets in Pakistan. This became a very big issue. So it doesn't surprise me in some ways that we're seeing a big outrage around Germany, even though in reality, frankly, you know, we've really surprised about this. Not really. I mean, they're picking up everyone's phone calls. I mean, sure, Angela Merkel's will be there somewhere, right? I mean,
70 million digital communications intercepted in France
now,
in a month.
Well, exactly. Now, yeah. Now this is...
That's staggering. First of all, how do you process that number?
About the French issue, because I think this is something separate from, you know, spying on leaders and other diplomats. As you say, this the other revelation which came out in Le Monde this week was that, yes, 70.3 million phone calls in just 30 days. Now, there is, as Jeffrey points out there, the issue of what on earth do you do with all this information once you've got it? But Raffaello, this is something different here, isn't it? Because this isn't trying to find out what, you know, Hollande's actually thinking behind closed doors. This is the sort of snooping on ordinary French citizens that got so many people alarmed about what PRISM and the NSA seem to be doing on American citizens.
But I mean, I wonder, I mean, is this 70.3 million items all of the phone calls that were made in France during that period of time? Or is there some sort of selector that they've done and it's just the selector they use is very large? So maybe it was everyone who's involved in investigation and all the phone numbers that they'd ever been in contact with. I simply don't know the exact specifics of that, but I could see that being a little more targeted. I mean, the other thing is about the French is the French are have one of the more active European intelligence services around. So, you know, probably they were listening to a lot of these people as well.
But I think that there are a couple of big picture questions here. And one of them is, why do we have spies? And I think that if all of us would agree that given 9/11 and 7/7 here in England, in the UK, if it's about counteracting terrorism, you're going to have a hard time finding people who are against it. But spying on world leaders, massing the communications of ordinary citizens suggests that this has become an industrial espionage age. And because it's also secret, there's no one overseeing these people. They write the rules. They keep them malleable. And of course, when journalists or the public or even politicians ask us, well, we have to be flexible to adapt. And you know, MI5 in the UK has doubled in size in the last decade. Now we have a pretty good idea what they're doing.
And Raffaella, that surely is part of the problem here, isn't it? In that... essentially, at the moment, the American response, in fact, every spy agency response has been, well, look, just trust us. Don't worry. Yeah. We know what we're doing. Yes. And, ooh, terrorism.
No, it's true. And it's a slightly disingenuous answer. I mean, at my institute, we had the head of MI5 come and give a presentation sometime earlier. I think it was last month or a couple of weeks ago. And he gave a presentation in which he gave very much the case for the security services and why they have to do all this stuff. And, you know, it was an interesting speech and it was very political and he sort of was treading into that minefield. And it was a little bit of this, you know, we got this. We know what we're doing. You should just trust us. And I can understand the hesitation and skepticism around that.
But I mean, that might convince someone like you.
No, I mean, I'll be honest, I listened to the presentation. It was interesting. And of course, you know, it was very well phrased and whatever else. But I did feel it was a little disingenuous in some parts. And I don't think he was really addressing the issue. I think the real issue is here the question of the oversight committees that we have in the United Kingdom. And I think it was incredibly unhelpful when the head of one of these oversight committees in Parliament, Malcolm Rifkin, came out and said, the intelligence services are really good. They have got this. Don't worry. I'm like, that was certainly not his sort of position to go and say that he should have stayed much more objective and impartial. So I think there's a whole question around that. I think the other element, which is interesting about this, which is something that Jeffrey sort of touched upon, is this whole notion of it becoming a sort of industrial thing. One of the things that the Americans always used to point at the Chinese in particular, when they would complain about Chinese snooping and spying, they would say, you know, you're not just doing it for security reasons and for these sorts of acceptable intelligence practices. You're doing this for commercial interests as well. The question I would ask is, if the Americans are trawling so much information and data, isn't there including leaders and business leaders sorts of information? Are they not veering in that direction as well? I mean, this entire story from the sort of US perspective has been a gift to the Chinese, who are having an absolute field day of this and saying, you know, every time the Americans start getting head up now, or anyone gets head up about cyber stuff, they can just say, well, hold on a second. You should go talk to Washington as well.
It's true. I mean, America's moral authority is really based now as much on example as it is on missiles. This really does a lot of damage. The extent of it suggests that this is not just a couple of random players. This is part of U.S. government policy and an underground level that we are not meant to have access. Which, of course, raises the question: Edward Snowden, hero or traitor?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because this was a rather black and white debate at the start of this, where he was either one or the other, and you had to come down on either side. And a lot of the Washington establishment were very quick to say, traitor. And so, for example, Richard Cohen in the Washington Post called him a traitor. This week, he's recanted that and said, you know what, I was far too hasty. He's actually, in a way, he may have gone against the American government, but he's sort of upheld American values. Do you think that the more that has emerged, the view of Edward Snowden, Jeffrey, is starting to change at all?
I think that this is a question that I would love to answer 10 or 20 years from now. I mean, I think we're still nearly chapters of the book on Edward Snowden, and I think we're just beginning to understand. And, you know, we don't know what's going to happen to him. He's stuck in Russia. He really is stateless. This is a guy, what is he, 27 years old. It's really hard to fathom what he's going through. But more importantly, to your question, it's hard to measure what the impact is. You read about the head of MI5 and UK politicians saying, and American politicians saying, that this is the worst security leak in history, and it's catastrophic. But I'm not aware of anyone who's died or any governments that have fallen because of it. And we are aware of a lot of things that actually a lot of us are comfortable being aware of. That the fact that this kind of industrial level spying is going on behalf of the UK and the US is something that I think a lot of us would like to know about.
Let's turn our attention to Pakistan. President Barack Obama and Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif met yesterday at the White House. And some people who read the Washington Post this morning woke up to a big new piece on drones, co-written by Bob Woodward. Some of it seemed to cover ground that actually some had sort of thought perhaps wasn't too new. But anyway, it laid out how the Pakistani government secretly condones airstrikes. A little bit earlier, we heard from Imtiaz Tayyab, Al Jazeera's man in Pakistan. Let's hear a bit about what he had to say.
Of course, the public here in Pakistan are very much against drone strikes. They say far too many civilians are killed in this, that this is a breach of Pakistan's sovereignty, that another country as far away as the United States is able to launch these predator drones into Pakistani airspace and to attack locations in Pakistan, mostly in North Waziristan. And like I was saying, it's very unpopular. But the reason I say it's a bit of a catch-22 for Nawaz Sharif is that at the end of the day, he is not in control of Pakistan's foreign policy. Pakistan's very powerful military is. And the military was, of course, very silent about drone strikes. You never hear the generals speaking about drone strikes, which is why there's always been accusations that Pakistan plays a bit of a double game when it comes to drone strikes, in the sense that some have suggested that they give their tacit approval to these strikes even to this day. But whatever the case is, in Washington, in the White House, Nawaz Sharif reiterated his point that he condemns drone strikes, that he doesn't want them to happen. And Mr. Obama, of course, in front of the media, said that while he felt the drone strikes were legal, it was a conversation that he was willing to have with Nawaz Sharif. So it's a bit of an awkward space for Mr. Sharif to sort of navigate in.
Now, as Imtiaz says there, Raffaello, he's in a bit of a tricky situation, Nawaz Sharif, isn't he? Because he's a leader that perhaps can't actually lead.
Well, yes. I mean, this is the perennial debate in Pakistan: is it the military or the civilians who control the situation? I think most would probably say that the military have a pretty solid hand on the rudder, shall we say. I think that the interesting, the story that you highlighted here, this one about drones and the fact that the Pakistanis were more aware than maybe had been officially said until now about the extent of these drone strikes, is interesting. And it's interesting, of course, that it lands exactly when Nawaz Sharif gets to town. This goes back to some of the elements of the last story we were talking about, you know, leaking coming out at certain points.
So why does this story come out right now, Jeffrey? I mean,
it's a blockbuster for the Washington Post.
And it is one of those things that it's a great story that sort of just confirms what people either knew or suspected all along.
I think you're exactly right. I think it does go back to what we were just talking about, that you've got Merkel and Hollande, as we were saying a moment ago, indignant about U.S. spying, and yet they do it themselves and they're aware of it. And so there is so much double talk in this part of diplomacy and international affairs. I don't think any of us who follow even lightly Pakistan would be are surprised to see that Pakistan in some way was doing a nod and a wink behind closed doors. But when doors were open and microphones were open, they were indignant and saying this was unacceptable. This is just the way it is. And partly because of what we were just talking about, that the government, the civilian government in Pakistan doesn't really control what happens. And so they have to play a bit of a game and walk a line that gives them, at least in their own mind, a sense of credibility.
Rafaela, when we look ahead, you know, the use of drones in the past 12 months in particular has become more and more of a hot topic. It was something that essentially people on the liberal left were getting very exercised about, but hadn't really come into the mainstream. In the last year or so, it really has become a major issue, hasn't it? How do you... And it's one of those tricky issues in as well that there's very little popularity for it, obviously, in the countries where it happens. But let's face it, Americans don't not like it because it means their troops aren't going to get killed.
I don't think it's just a case of politicians not wanting to lose their soldiers. I think intelligence services will tell you that these things give them a capacity and a reach that they simply don't have otherwise. It means that they can target individuals who they're particularly concerned about in a way that they simply can't get to in any other way. And so from their perspective, they would like to continue. So I think I would point out that in the last year, we've seen a distinct drop-off in the volume of usage of these drones, because I think there is a perception within Washington, at least, that, because Washington's the one who controls the drones, so of course there, that... Was this really solving the problem? And, you know, was it just that this is the one tool you had and so you just hit your problem with this every single time? And, you know, you play that out, where does that sort of end?
Well, you look at the numbers of civilians that are killed by these.
The problem with the civilians is I don't know if anyone really knows for certain. I mean, I saw the Human Rights Watch put out a report this week.
It was a joint report.
A joint report, okay. Which suggested numbers were higher. And I suspect they're probably higher than the official numbers that the government will put out. However, I'm not so sure that they aren't trying to pay attention and be careful about who they're trying to hit with these things. I think part of the reason that they've toned them down in the past year is because they've raised considerably the threshold of who they would be willing to target with these things.
And this again goes back to what we were talking about earlier, when whether it's espionage or military hardware, I think most Americans and most people in the West would support efforts to control and curb terrorist activity, and if the perception is that, then you're going to find public opinion in this part of the world in favor of these things. The issue, of course, that keeps coming up is: are they in fact recruiting devices for Al Qaeda because they are so antagonizing people in that region?
Quite, and I'm afraid on that point we're going to have to leave it there, Rafaela and Jeffrey. We'll be back in a moment, though, to talk about Syria.
The rugged and romantic Scottish Highlands are not the Glenlivet's only inspiration. Since 1824, this single malt has combined unique flavours to create one of the world's most awarded whiskies. The Guardian's Chapter is their next limited edition whisky, with a taste that will be decided by the Glenlivet's own community of enthusiasts from around the world. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love, generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And you're back with Aperitivo 2024 in Istanbul, 1824 here in London. My guests are Jeffrey Kaufman and Raffaele Pantucci. We're going to turn to Syria now. There are supposed to be, we hope, we think, peace talks in Geneva, so-called Geneva 2 talks, starting next month. But Raffaello, John Kerry, the Secretary of State in the US, is obviously very, very keen on these. President Bashar al-Assad, oddly, seems to be quite up for them. Syrian rebels and other people, it seems, within the US administration, less so.
Well, I think the fundamental problem here is the opposition in Syria, which is absolutely not a coherent entity. We are dealing with all sorts of factions and groups, and it's not clear that any of them who the people who are actually talking to are really the ones who control the levers of power. I think a lot of the armed groups on the ground, who probably are really the influencers and the ones who really control the territory, they're probably not going to get involved in these sorts of discussions. And so the dilemma becomes, does the United States champion a discussion that is ultimately going to have no one really relevant to the table? President Bashar al-Assad, of course, he's delighted to go and do it. This shows he's still relevant and he's still an important figure within this, and that, you know, presumptively, if a peace agreement needs to be reached, he will have to be part of that, and he will, you know, therefore have to remain in power in some way, shape or form. I think that this points to a bigger problem within the whole Syria, the whole Syrian civil war, which is its intractable nature. And it's increasingly sort of, we're seeing, I think, a reality develop on the ground of groups that are controlling piece of territory that is becoming de facto. And so you're losing a sort of coherency on either side in terms of the opposition or in terms of, I think, probably the leadership or certainly in terms of the international players.
Well, you're describing exactly what I experienced when I covered the Libyan revolution and the time afterwards. And this is Libya. I think I've said it before on one of these Monocle appearances. This is Libya on steroids. Mm. So much more significant in terms of the geopolitical impact, so much more divided. And I think you're absolutely right, Raphael. The Syrian National Council, the Syrian Opposition Coalition, you know, they can go and sit at tables and they can put signs in front of them, but it's not clear that they can say anything that really has any impact. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, they have no choice but to say they're going to boycott, because if they were to say, well, if you do this and this, we'll show up, which they want Assad to agree to stand down.
He's not going to do that.
Well, the problem for the U.S. is that they're not supporting the rebels, and now they've backed off a bombing campaign, and that really leaves us in this stalemate. And the consequences of stalemate in Syria are so much more significant than the consequences of stalemate in Libya.
Stalemate is one word, but in a sense, it's worse than that, because if you're a rebel in Syria who is, you know, wanted the support of the West, and frankly, it's not happening, you're going to grow a beard and get support from somewhere else instead.
It's a fair point. The problem, of course, is that as we've become aware of the way the rebels act, it's hard to sanction their behavior as well. Mm. When they resort to torture and human rights violations, not all of them, but some of them. And, you know, it's not like they're wearing uniforms and the guys in blue are good and the guys in green are bad. It's much more complex than that. And so the U.S. understandably has been reluctant to send in arms that could be used by some of these bad actors.
Can I try and just put in a small amount of potential optimism, which you can then sort of completely shout down? But if we look at the bigger picture at the moment, there are Israeli-Palestine peace talks, there are Iran nuclear talks, and there is the prospect of some sort of Syria talks. We've already had a deal over chemical weapons. All three of those would have been pretty far-fetched this time last year, Raffaello, wouldn't they?
Well, I'll be perfectly honest. I think on the Israel-Palestine ones, I remain skeptical. We've heard this discussion a few times in the past. I think on the Syria ones, I think for all the reasons that we've been discussing, I think I'm very hesitant to say that Geneva 2 is going to suddenly bring the panacea to these problems that we've been talking about. The one that I'm more optimistic about is, in a way, the Iranian one, because we are seeing Rouhani come out, and at least the early signals are positive, and he does seem to be following it up with some sort of action. So it's possible that we're seeing an opening there. And if we do see positive movement in that direction, it's possible that this will have a sort of domino impact on some of the others as well.
Exactly, because Syria in many ways is a last gasp of the Cold War. And you've got, it's a proxy fight between not just the U.S. and Russia, but between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And if Iran comes in a little bit from out of the cold, that does... Then we'll allow you to be an ounce of optimism. But it's only that is the one perhaps opening here. But I just think that to a certain degree, it's in the interest of the U.S., not just the U.S., but many of the actors I've just mentioned, to see Saudi Arabia sputter along and with this kind of murderous civil war continuing at a low grade level.
Well, I mean, the point I was going to make, that while we can see optimism in the Iranian direction, we've seen in this past week tensions between the U.S. and Saudi, as the Saudis start to get angry to see the U.S. is moving in that direction to support the Iranians, who is, of course, their antithetical, you know, the Shia apostate regime that is behind everything there. Again, so, you know, this is the problem with Middle Eastern politics. You know, you move positive in one direction and then you're sort of tipping another scale.
Perfect place to end. Jeffrey Kaufman from ABC News and Raffaella Pantucci, Senior Research Fellow at RUSI. Thank you both very much. You're listening to Aperitivo.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ut London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
So plenty still to come in the second half of today's aperitivo. We'll be heading to the Monocle Cafe to talk with the director of the Royal Ballet, no less. We'll also preview what's coming up on today's Globalist Asia and Monocle Daily, plus a rather strange peer into the future. But first, here's David Spencer with the latest news headlines.
Steve, thank you very much indeed. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has accused the United States of an unacceptable breach of trust after allegations that the US bugged her personal mobile phone. The issue has overshadowed the start of a two-day summit in Brussels. There have also been claims this week about the monitoring of calls in France by America's National Security Agency. Pakistan has affirmed its opposition to drone strikes by the United States, despite revelations that Islamabad had secretly endorsed the strikes for several years. The Washington Post has reported that while top Pakistani officials denounced the drone program, they are routinely given classified briefings on targets and casualties. A Chinese newspaper has once again published a front-page plea for the release of one of its journalists held by police. Chen Yongzhou was detained by officers after he wrote several articles claiming corruption at a part state-owned company. It's been revealed that the bushfires, which destroyed more than 200 homes in the Blue Mountains area of New South Wales, were started by an Australian army exercise. Residents have been allowed to return to their homes, but the crisis is far from over, with more than 50 blazes still alight. Ukrainian former world heavyweight boxing champion Vitali Klitschko has confirmed he will run in the country's 2015 presidential election. That's despite a vote in parliament that could prevent his bid because he has a residency permit issued in Germany. Those are latest headlines on Monocle 24.
And from a professional point of view, I'm delighted that Vitali Klitschko is standing for election, because I've just commissioned a big interview with him for the next issue of Monocle. So, yes, let's hope that happens. The time is 18.33 here in London. You're listening to Aperitivo live on Monocle 24. Time now to head down the road to the Monocle Cafe. Today, we're meeting Kevin O'Hare, director of the Royal Ballet here in London since 2012. He's at the cafe with Monocle's Daphne Denis. So, what's on at the moment, when can we see it, and how is the ballet adapting with a new generation in the audience? Daphne, over to you.
Thank you, Steve. Kevin O'Hare, thank you so much for sitting down with me here at the Monocle Cafe. You've been the director of the Royal Ballet since 2012. So my first question is, how has the job treated you so far?
Well, it's pretty full on, I have to say. I sort of knew what I was getting into because I've been working with the Royal Ballet in all different sorts of ways for many years. And I was actually at the Royal Ballet School, so I know the world very much. But it has taken me by surprise, just the volume of the work that we have to do and what we want to do as well. So apart from the performances that we do at the Opera House, we're also doing live cinema relays. We're doing lots of education work, looking after the healthcare of dancers. So there's a lot that goes on. So my days are pretty full. So it's quite nice to come here and have a coffee and a bit of a relaxation.
Tell us about what we can see right now. What's up in the winter season? What should we get ready for?
Well, we just opened about 4 weeks ago, and we opened with a big splash with Carlos Acosta's brand new version of Don Quixote. And that's been a great success. We've been sold out every performance, and I think we've got about 4 or 5 more shows to go of that over the next couple of weeks. There are some day seats that you can get, but apart from that, there's no tickets. And then last week we opened a run of Romeo and Juliet, and that runs right through to December. And then, very excitingly, I've just come from a rehearsal of a new creation by an Englishman called David Dawson, but he's never actually created on an English ballet company. His work has been seen in Europe a lot, and he was resident choreographer in Dresden and also at Dutch National Ballet. And he's creating a new piece for us in a mixed program, and that is also against The Rite of Spring, which is Kenneth MacMillan's amazing version of The Rite of Spring, and also Wayne McGregor's huge hit, which is Chroma, which is a piece that we did since 2006, I think, but it's to White Stripes music, arranged by Joby Talbot. And John Paulson has designed the set, and it's a real antidote to everything anybody can think about classical ballet.
Well, that ties in really well with my next question. Ballet is something that strikes us as such a classical genre, such a classical art. How do you go about renovating it, modernizing it, and maybe attracting new people to look at it and give it a try?
I think it's a mixture of a few things. The sort of work we do, who we engage with, how we get them to see it if they can't come to the Opera House, and also, the sort of price, to be honest, as well. And so I'm really pleased that this program I was just talking about with Chroma and the Rite of Spring and the new David Dawson, at the top price is £40 for the best seat in the house. It's quite amazing when you think you can't really go and see a play in the West End for that. And I think the cheapest seat is about £3 or something like that, and a range between them. So I think that really is great for people to be able to come and afford to come and see what we do. And then the sort of work. I mean, obviously having somebody like the White Stripes, their music, that brings in a different crowd of people. And then Wayne McGregor himself, who's our resident choreographer, he's such an integral part of what we do at the Royal Ballet now, but he's brought so many different people into the building, and that's really important for us.
I think you've very much spoken about the fact that you wanted to widen your audience, not necessarily replace it. And sometimes it feels like when a ballet director, an opera director, makes such a bold move in scenography, for instance, it seems that some people are a bit upset about it, maybe those who want something more classical. How do you sort of strike the right balance between attracting new people but also sort of being nice to the ones who already love ballet?
Yes, it is hard. It's a huge balance. We do about 12 programs a year, so I have 12 programs to play around with. So we do the 19th century classics, the Swan Lakes, the Sleeping Beauties, whatever, a mixture of those through the season. We also have an amazing heritage of our own works, which are by Sir Frederick Ashton and Kenneth MacMillan, and Sir Kenneth MacMillan. And then, of course, I'm wanting to push forward with the new work. So it's trying to get that balance because, of course, the dancers as well want that. And that's why we are very lucky to have such an amazing array of classical dancers, because they want to dance this wide range of repertoire. And I think really it's, sort of trying to make everybody sort of try a bit of everything, really, like the dancers do. And I mean, they trained all those years to do Swan Lake, so of course they want to do Swan Lake and the classical things, but they also want to be pushed to the limits. And what I love about the new work is that you see what the body can do nowadays. I mean, it's amazing what I, as a dancer, couldn't even dream of doing what 20 years ago I did. It's nothing like what they do now.
And my last question, really briefly, what's your proudest moment thus far? What's your most proud achievement?
Wow, that's a big one. I think I was very proud on the first night of Don Quixote. Actually, it was a great production. It was a great start to the season. Carlos has done an amazing production, and you can actually, I'm going to a plug here. We did have it live in cinema, but you can see it on TV at Christmas on BBC. So do see it, because I think it's a fresh view of a classic, and that's what we're trying to do at the Royal Ballet: see the classics through fresh eyes.
Thank you so much, Kevin O'Hare. Steve, back to you in Studio One.
Daphne, thank you very much indeed. That was our very own Daphne Denis with Kevin O'Hare, director of the Royal Ballet. After the break, we'll ask if the world will end by 2050. Don't worry, our next guest reckons it won't. Stay tuned. You're listening to Aperitivo.
The Glenlivet was the first single malt to successfully cross the Atlantic Ocean. And since that first journey, the world-renowned whiskey has never looked back. Now, master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting their global community of whiskey connoisseurs, the guardians of the Glenlivet, to help create their next limited edition whiskey. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
In Istanbul, they took to the streets in a battle for green space. In Sao Paulo, they marched in their thousands in a fight for cheaper buses. In Athens, they shouted loud to demand a better run capital. That's why urbanism matters, why words like density, infrastructure, and smart cities need to be dragged out of city hall conclaves and turned into a public debate. And that's why every week Monocle's show, The Urbanist, reports from cities around the world that are getting horribly wrong and deliciously right, visits the mavericks and mayors with a vision further than the edge of their desk, and asks the questions that will shape how we live tomorrow.
Who governs the city? Who owns the city? Who has the right to decide what happens in the city?
The bridge becomes an instrument not of moving traffic, but of land development.
There needs to be a voice for the people that says, okay, now we need a library, now we need the green park. These things that are greater than the individual interests.
Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
And you're back with Aperitivo with me, Steve Bloomfield. Now, what might the world look like in the year 2050? If you thought off-the-charts inequality, the brink of nuclear disaster, or perhaps even worse, then you're clearly not Alex Mackay. Alex, who became a history teacher at Ashton Vale Community College in the early 2020s, has reasons to be optimistic. Confused? Well, it's all the premise of a new book, The World We Made, part history that never happened, part fictional personal memoir. Mackay is the invention of Jonathan Porritt, who hopes to show how the world can look 37 years from now if, as the book says, we play our cards right. Porritt is Britain's foremost environmentalist, a one-time director of Friends of the Earth and the head of the UK government's Sustainable Development Commission. I spoke with Jonathan a little bit earlier. This book, The World We Made, it's unapologetically optimistic, isn't it? I mean, because if you look at the world at the moment, it's quite hard to find much to be optimistic about. The resources we're using, the political responses, poverty, and yet, says here, everything's sorted by 2050.
Not quite. Not everything. There are still a number of things we have to do in 2050 that we don't get sorted until the end of the century. But you're right, it is deliberately upbeat. It is full of hope that we still have time and the will and the technology to make all the changes we need to make to deliver a pretty good world for 8.6, 9 billion people by 2050. I wouldn't put it more than that. It's not a brilliant world. There's still a lot of poverty. Climate change is still causing a huge amount of damage in our society in 2050. We've still got massive problems in terms of pollution, biodiversity, and so on. But we're on the right journey. We've turned around this crazy juggernaut of life-trashing progress today, and we've created something that actually works far better for the vast majority of human beings.
Before we get into what some of those things are, which you think are achievable within the next generation or so, do you think that people in your world have had a problem in terms of sounding a little bit too pessimistic in the past? Quite rightly so, saying, look, if we don't do this, we're all doomed. And yet that can not always appeal to everyone on the street.
Absolutely. And it's been a psychological conundrum for quite some time, really, because if you reflect the state of the planet as it is now, in reality, you're going to be telling people some pretty gloomy things. We know that that doesn't leave people feeling empowered, feeling capable of doing more than they might be doing anyway. It doesn't persuade them to change their ways. So we've been stuck in that trap for a long time. And actually, we set the Forum for the Future up in 1996 specifically to counter that whole doom and gloom diet, the way in which people just sink into this sense of powerlessness. So it's complicated because false optimism, based on no real understanding of the state of the world today, is almost worse than the pessimism that we've seen so much of over the last 20, 30 years.
Well, you mentioned false optimism, and let's look at page 15 here in your book. There's a mock-up of The Economist from March 2016 saying solar sweeps the field. Now, here in this country, we're talking about nuclear energy, and there was a very viable hydroelectric program that could have been brought in by this government, which was ignored. We've gone down a nuclear route. There's no way the solar's going to sweep the field in 3 years' time, is there?
In the UK, probably not. In the world, absolutely. And what is happening is simply an issue about market economics. Costs of solar, of that technology, photovoltaics, are falling by between 6 to 8% every year. Efficiencies are increasing every year. It's becoming more and more competitive, particularly in countries that have slightly more sunshine than we do. And you almost don't have to put solar in the context of climate change. Just put it in the context of market economics, because that's where it has to win. It has to be able to beat electricity from gas, electricity from coal, electricity from any other source of energy. And it will. And by 2016, The Economist writes the article that says if you project this forward another 20 years, you can see how solar will command 30% of total electricity generation by 2050. That is not unrealistic, by the way. There are a ton of people who would agree with that particular projection.
Now, I want to bring you on to another projection, which is from 2020, where, and I don't know which one's more ridiculous, the fact that you've got a front page story saying climate deal done, or the fact that the front page story is on a magazine called Newsweek, which I'd be surprised if that's back with us. But when we talk about, you know, solar or the fact that climate deals could be done in 2020, the big thing here we're saying isn't that the technology isn't there, but that really at the moment the political will doesn't seem to be there. What is it that makes you think that we're going to have a more enlightened set of leaders in, you know, let's say 7 years' time in 2020, that can get a climate deal done that's a genuine climate deal that actually makes a huge difference?
Two big things happen, and they are big, you're right. The first thing is we have to have an even more dramatic set of shocks to the system, things going wrong. It's one of those paradoxes of our world that we need a lot of climate-induced pain in the short term to avoid the apocalyptic pain in the longer term. And we're going to get those
slightly
shocks.
Slightly Bolshevik there.
No. Just think what's happening.
Things get worse before they can get better.
Well, think what's happening in Australia today. They've just elected Tony Abbott, one of the most rebarbatively stupid climate-denying politicians on the face of the earth. And hey presto, within a few weeks of him being elected, they have the worst forest fires they've ever had at a point in the season where they never get forest fires. And people are sitting around in Australia saying, oh my God, we've just elected someone who denies there's any connection between forest fires and climate change.
Except they're not saying that, though, are they? Because actually there were horrific forest fires a year ago, and they still elected him.
Yeah, no, I know, but this is completely out of the norm. They never get forest fires this intense. This is the equivalent of, this is in April, May, in our seasonal terms. So by and large, you never get temperatures hot enough at this point in the climate in Australia.
I understand what you're trying to say, but you know, the political reality is if there was another election today, Tony Abbott would still win.
Probably not, actually.
Really?
No. No. It doesn't take many weeks to work out how stupid he is. But let's not worry about Tony Abbott. Let's talk more about the shocks to the system, okay? Because that is, you're absolutely right. Our politicians today have not understood the depth of this accelerating climate change crisis. So we're going to have more shocks to the system. That's one change. Technology is going to do a lot of the heavy lifting there, because actually we have the technologies now to make a low carbon economy a reality. And thirdly, in 2018, young people, so not my generation or most of the politicians in power today, but young people rise up and they just say, sod it. This is completely ridiculous. You can't go on denying the laws of physics. You can't go on pretending that the world looks one way when actually we can already see it looks another way.
And yet, I see what you're saying, and I hope you're right. But if we were to look at where we were on climate change politics just a few years ago, you'd had the Stern report, which was here in Britain, which went all over the world, pointing out just the financial case, the economic case for why we need to deal with climate change. You had the election of Barack Obama, who, in one line said we're going to slow the rise of the oceans and cool the planet. And yet we're now in a situation where Barack Obama is now thinking about a new oil pipeline from Canada through to the US. In this country, we've got a government which said it was going to be the greenest government ever, and has just today been saying, or yesterday been saying, actually we're going to get rid of all our green levies on energy. It's the political reality of right now seems to go against all these grand hopes you have.
Of course, if you look at it in terms of where we are today in 2013, it is terribly easy to get yourself very depressed and to get your listeners very depressed, which you're doing an excellent job of here, I must say. What you have to do is accept one thing. We will, absolutely will, work out how to get to a low carbon, good economy for people. We really will do that. And we'll either do it in a timely, planned, expeditious kind of way where we make cost-effective investments in new technologies and we sort of work out how to do this, or we'll be shocked into it at some distant point in the future. That's the only choice. Not that we won't do it, because we will have to do it in one way or another. So just put it like that. Are we going to do it sensibly on the basis of the knowledge we have now and a different kind of political leadership driven primarily by young people who are really not going to put up with this any longer? Or are we going to wait until the political system melts down and then we do it too late, probably at such a costly level that nobody will be prepared for it anyway?
Is there any country, any government, which you look at now and think, actually, forget in 20 years' time, right now they understand what the challenges are?
Absolutely.
Where?
Compare us with what's happening in Germany. Germany is already generating more than 23% of its electricity from renewable power. Germany is already investing in the technologies of the future. It can already see what a low-carbon future looks like. Look at what's happening in Denmark, in Sweden, in Costa Rica, for instance. All over the world, we have got examples of governments that are far-sighted enough to take advantage of today's technology to make this change in a planned and cost-effective way. I'd much rather look at what's happening in Germany than in Australia or in our own backyard here in the UK.
There we are. That was Jonathan Porritt speaking to me a little bit earlier. His new book is called The World We Made. There was only really one song we could play after this. It's REM. You know what it is. That's great. It starts with an earthquake. Birds and snakes. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world. I trust you were singing along at home. REM, the end of the world as we know it. Almost the end of the show as we know it. But I feel fine because I've been joined by... Sorry. I've been joined by Annabelle Bly, producer of The Monocle Daily, and Emma Nelson, host of Globalist Asia, both shows coming up very, very shortly. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. You're a smooth talker, Steve Bloomfield.
Well, I like to try. Annabelle, on the daily tonight, so in just over 3 hours' time, I'm quite excited about one of these stories. I'm excited about the whole show, obviously.
But, yeah, of course.
We're going to be talking about shared workspaces, which is actually more interesting than I've just made it sound there. we're looking at a place called Neue House in particular in New York, which is where we held a big event actually just last week, which our editor Andrew Tuck was rather taken by. What are we going to be talking about?
Well, we're just going to be having a discussion on what works best for different people and looking at how different companies have operated. And there's been a huge number of developments in recent years over how companies operate and how they have their employees working.
And it's interesting as well, isn't it, Emma? Because, you know, all of a sudden, everyone's supposed to be able to work at home because we'd have super fast fiber optic broadband.
Doesn't
and everyone,
work that
everyone
way,
started
does it?
Work at home. It's like, it's a bit boring. There's no one to flirt with over the water cooler. And so they're going to these sort of new sort of shared spaces, which aren't actually that expensive.
No, they're lovely. And they encourage startups and they encourage creativity quite amazingly. They're very big in Germany as well. And they're very, very big in San Francisco, where they really do enjoy putting like-minded, brainy people together. It makes total sense. One thing that I'm always concerned about is that you end up with some sort of open plan, big sort of playground, and no one ever gets any work done.
Well, yes, that is always a fear. It's a little bit like our editorial floor.
Didn't want to mention
no,
that.
No, indeed. So we've got, after Aperitivo, obviously, it's The Urbanist. We'll tell you a bit more about that in a moment. Then it's Globist Asia, Emma, which you're presenting.
I am.
We're going to be talking about Aung San Suu Kyi at the start, aren't we?
She just has. Briefly. She's denied in a radio interview that there's a campaign of ethnic cleansing in Burma. Obviously, since for about a year now, there's been really horrific sectarian violence between Buddhists and Muslims. Most of the violence is directed against the Rohingya Muslims. And earlier on this year, Human Rights Watch warned that there was this campaign of ethnic cleansing being carried out against the Muslims. There's been fierce criticism of Aung San Suu Kyi for effectively defending her government. And so we'll be talking about that in a little over an hour.
Excellent. Emma Nelson, thank you very much indeed. Amel Blight, thank you too. That's all we have time for on today's Aperitivo. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Jeffrey Kaufman, London correspondent for ABC News, and Raffaello Pantucci, senior research fellow at RUSI. And here's a little bit, if you missed it, of what Raffaello had to say about the prospect for Syrian peace talks in Geneva.
Well, I think the fundamental problem here is the opposition in Syria, which is absolutely not a coherent entity. We are dealing with all sorts of factions and groups, and it's not clear that any of them, who the people who are actually talking to, are really the ones who control the levers of power.
Aperitivo was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Alexa Firmanich and Harriet Thorpe. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Next up is The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck, where we'll discover the new city in Philippines and ask, how do you build an effective new city?
So I think it's important that if you're an urban planner, to understand and very consciously plan the city, knowing that human beings will live in it.
I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists across 7 disciplines and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. For Rolex, it's a chance to ensure the world's artistic legacy is passed on to the next generation. 1 year can inspire a lifetime.